Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And this is our first remote recording for the show. None of us are actually in the studio except Chris. She's not at HCC, so she's doing this from home too. How cool. So we are all in three remote locations doing this with Zoom. And our first show, we're going to talk about the movie Seberg and The Way Back. So Mike, starting with Seberg, what were your first reactions to the movie?
Well, I've always been fascinated by Jean Seberg as an actress. And just to remind our audience, because her name's not going to be familiar to everybody, the fact that she was somebody who came on the scene in the late 1950s. She's a farm girl, if you will, out of Iowa. I mean, sort of a classic middle American background, and by her late teens getting into movies. And it all has that kind of golden glow, if you know what I mean, of, you know, in that period of American film history, how as a young woman, suddenly, you know, before you're an adult or barely an adult, you become a movie star, and then a troubled life after that. It has all the makings for a really good biopic, doesn't it, in terms of a kind of tragic life story. And just to remind the audience a bit in terms of, you know, what put her on the cinematic map at the time, initially the director Otto Preminger with the film St. Joan in 1957 and then followed up with Bonjour Tristesse in 1958, but what really permanently has placed her in that cinematic firmament, if you will, was, of course, when she co-starred in Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless in 1960, one of the classics of the French New Wave. And her character is perfectly realized by the actor because, you know, Jean Seberg in that movie plays an American college student, you know, at the Sorbonne who, you know, gets mixed up in some gangster-related mischief in Paris in a kind of on-again, off-again romance. But she was just the right age, just the right look, just the right haircut, if you will. And then after that, the life and the cinematic career really have their ups and downs and, frankly, mostly downs. And we can talk about that as we go into it, but just to kind of get her placed that way that, in Hollywood, it's Otto Preminger who kind of puts her before the public, and then for an international audience, in a more lasting way, I would argue, Godard with Breathless in 1960, because it really is one of the absolute icons of French cinema, and she's right at the heart of it. So, again, just by way of prefacing, you know, that she's really great subject matter for film. I have very mixed feelings about the film itself in that regard, but let me throw it back to you now in terms of your impressions of Seberg.
Well, you know, my first exposure to her was in Breathless, and then I found out she was in Bonjour Tristesse, which was, it's a Francois Sagan novel, and she's perfect in that role. So I had read the book, I didn't know she was in the movie, I was very pleased to see her in the movie, perfectly cast. I think she's iconic because she has a particular look, that really short, what I think of as the Shirley Partridge hairstyle. But she was able to be an American famous movie star in France, and she I think she was more appreciated in France than she was in the US, but she had a very tragic life really and came to a bad end, so that's like the real life story.
I want to linger on the hairdo for, I always get fascinated and fixated on hairdos, I think, because so often when you think about it, what makes a performer distinctive, whether it's the, you know, the physical build or the makeup or the haircut, whatever. And certainly, you know what I was thinking of, and it might seem like initially like an odd analogy, but I was thinking about Louise Brooks. I'll tell you why, because
yes,
in the 1920s, Louise Brooks made some Hollywood movies and, you know, was making a name for herself as a star, but really it was when she went to Germany and made, you know, some films there that she really in a lasting way got fixed in our collective memory. And not to dwell on it too long, but she had that very distinctive and very dark bob, if you will, that, you know, kind of a, you know, straight razor, if you will, cutting it off at the forehead, but a very distinctive late 20s flapper appropriate hairdo. And whenever you talk about Louise Brooks, you have to talk about her hair, right? So whenever you talk about Jean Seberg, and I only sound facetious, I'm really serious about this, whenever you talk about Jean Seberg, you have to talk about that blonde haircut, because it's perfect for, it's sort of waifish, pixious, it's kind of proto-punk even in some ways, but it's shorter than most women would have had their hair at the time, and it really makes her as a sort of prototypically modern woman in a lot of ways. Certainly in the Godard film she plays that, a young woman who's testing boundaries and limits, and the hairdo also kind of looks ahead. I mean, it's, think about how most actors had their hair, female actors in the late 50s. I mean, the big bouffants, the, you know, very elaborate or very long, I mean, just very something, right? But with her, it was more minimal, it was cut short, and almost androgynous, almost kind of boyish, and it sort of looks ahead, if you think about it, to jump ahead 10 years, you know, someone like Twiggy, right? I mean, it sort of jumps ahead to hairstyles of the 60s more than harking back to the earlier 50s. What do you think?
I think that's a very astute thing to say. And mentioning Louise Brooks, even if you've never seen anything Louise Brooks has done in a movie, everybody knows that hairstyle.
Yeah, you know,
as
we're talking about it, I'm visualizing it as we're talking about it. I mean, and I think Gene Seberg is similar that way. And it's one of the things that the film we're talking about, Seberg, gets right. Whoever did the hairstyling really got the look, didn't she?
They did, and that was one of the things that I thought it was good that they cast Kristen Stewart, if only for the fact that not everybody can make that hairstyle work.
Well, that's true. In fact, it could look ludicrous on, I mean, we won't mention names and get silly with it, but it would look ludicrous on certain people, right? But you know, you think
would.
Of other actors who might be great actors, but not in that haircut, right?
And it's
but,
funny,
but Kristen,
the 60s were going to bring us all of those bouffant Priscilla Presley dudes.
Well, but the thing is, but there's a certain breaking point where carrying into the 60s, you still have that. You see it reflected in Motown hairstyles and fashion ads and all that. But then there's that break, more mid to late 60s, where at least some, like, really cool women, sort of cutting-edge women, start to go for other looks. And I would say that Jean Seberg, again, was a kind of harbinger of that, that by the late 50s, and again, you know, I think about the film Breathless, it's sort of quasi-beatnik. I mean, it has that quality to it, and you know, certainly a bohemian quality to it. And one of the things that kicks it ahead into modernity isn't just Godard's filmmaking in a technical sense and in a narrative sense, but the way in which that character is presented. She really is a forward-looking woman in a lot of ways, and that's why fashion and certainly hairstyling and all that's, you know, directly relevant.
Now, I would like to say one thing that I think was very strong in this movie was the fashion. That they put, all the clothes that they put Kristen Stewart in were absolutely perfect. Every single outfit, I thought that, you know, you wouldn't put those colors together now. And I don't know if
oh
they
my goodness,
you know,
no.
modeled it on clothes she actually wore, but the clothing is fabulous in this movie.
Well, here's an analogy by way of domestic decor. When you think about some of those outfits that mod, and mod would have been the word a lot of people to use in mid
to
late 60s.
It's very mod, yes.
Because the movie takes place in 1968, and we'll talk more about that, but that kind of mod fashion, and that's why I was mentioning Twiggy, for instance, it's right in that period. The domestic analogy would be when you think about how people were decorating their kitchens back then, those combinations of lemon and lime and orange and, you know, colors that don't go together in nature or shouldn't go together anywhere, but how often they went together. If you watch TV sitcoms, when I was teaching a course on television, you watch TV sitcoms from the late 60s and certainly the early 70s, some of those color combinations are, to put it politely, arresting. And you realize that people, and then you look at the dresses, I almost think like the Brady Bunch, right? You think about the dresses that they were wearing doing the same thing. I mean, this is the period that the film is evoking very, very well. And though, again, even though I had really mixed feelings about it as a film, the look is right, not just her hair, but the costuming, just the period decor. So individual scenes work incredibly well, you know, in terms of really making you feel as if you've been immersed in that period.
Now, in terms of the historical facts that are in this movie, what do you think about how good it is a movie in terms of rendering the actual story of Jean Seberg?
Well, this is where it starts to fall apart, and I'll tell you why. By the mid-60s, mid to late 60s, it's a combination of things. She never became like a really big A-list star, right? She never really, you know, ascended quite that high. And then in terms of Hollywood, not quite knowing what to do with her, some bad career choices, bad marital choices too. We can talk about her husband, the French writer Romain Gary, but all that kind of converges or coalesces to both personal and professional setbacks. And here's a for instance, and it's actually directly relevant because the movie's set in 1968. She's working on a new role. It's actually the misconceived, misguided musical Paint Your Wagon, which would be released in 1969. She really can't sing, and goodness knows Clint Eastwood can't either. And here they are singing, and it's just a weird, you know, the film's interesting just because of all the ways it doesn't quite work, right? But that's the period when the film itself that we're watching takes place. And so all that's quite accurate to the period. What's also accurate is that because her politics were left of center, you know, certainly in the 50s and 60s, the FBI had its eyes on her. And moreover, she really made the situation worse, though from her perspective she wouldn't have put it this way, but the fact that, you know, she's already left of center politically, what does she do? Well, she becomes involved with the Black Panthers. And, you know, and that's like such a hot button issue. And regardless of how you feel, you know, in terms of the Black Panthers yourself, I mean, whatever your own politics are, from a Hollywood movie star perspective, it's like career suicide, isn't it? You know, if you're going to be a mainline Hollywood star, and here you are running around with and frankly sleeping with the Black Panthers, it doesn't play well in the pages of the Hollywood Reporter or Variety or whatever. You know, it just really sort of gets her labeled that way. And this is where there is still a lot of speculation. We know the FBI had a file on her. We know she was persecuted that way. We know they spread false rumors. J. Edgar Hoover was not shy about tapping phones and fomenting that kind of stuff. So that's all more or less accurate, but the speculation is as to the extent to which it really led to her what's presumed to be a suicide at the age of 40. And I have the quotation marks around that. It's always been assumed that it was a suicide. But again, this is where the speculation is going to always remain that. We're not entirely sure. It's almost like with Marilyn Monroe. Did Marilyn Monroe kill herself? Well, she did have an overdose of sleeping pills and all, but was it a deliberate suicide? The consensus is that Seberg killed herself, but again, you can't definitively say that. So that's where it gets a little squishy. And if I could segue from that to what I think is the real failing of the film, there's so much really great material here. And I wish it had focused more on two things. One is on the actual film career, which when you think about it, only gets mentioned in passing. We said more about Preminger's films and the Godard film than I think this film Seberg says. You know, it really doesn't devote much time to that. And it's a shame because it's an interesting filmography. A second thing that really falls short is in terms of her personal life, you do get, you know, a sense of the lovers and the husband and this and that, but it doesn't really spend as much time as inconsistently with those characters to get a feel for it. And what's tantalizing there is when she takes as a lover the Black activist character named Hakeem Jamal, he warns her, "You're playing with fire." That's an exact quote. He says, "You're playing with fire," and, which she is, of course. And I wanted more time spent on that by way of a kind of armchair psychoanalysis. Like, does she know the extent to which? Because she seems kind of like naive, like Hollywood starlet naive or something, as to what the ramifications could be of all this. But it's hard to say for sure because the film doesn't really dwell on it enough. And then there's like a metaphoric connection that I wish the film had played up more. Think about it. Her career began playing Joan of Arc. She was St. Joan. She was already burned at the stake in the late 50s, right?
And now we have this character. Me, right?
Yeah, now this character, this, and Hakeem actually says to her, "You're playing with fire." And I thought, boy, is she ever. But the film could, without being heavy-handed, the film could have done more with that. But here's the absolute failing of the film, I think, and the reason it doesn't work much as a biopic. And honestly, I never thought I'd say I wish it had been more of a conventional biopic, because I like unusual films, but honestly, I do wish it had been more of a conventional biopic. And here's specifically why. Within the script, it doesn't spend enough time on all the things I just mentioned, but it spends too much time with a fictional, and I'd call him conscience-stricken FBI agent character, Jack Solomon, played by the actor Jack O'Connell. That's a totally made-up character. Whether there was an actual FBI agent who felt that way at all. But this film, I guess it's trying to be fair and balanced or something, but as the FBI is spying on her, it spends as much time with this fictional FBI agent as it does with Seberg. And frankly, number one, he's not as interesting. Number two, I always thought, well, yeah, but he's a fictional character. Let's get back to something that's really reality-based here and, you know, not this kind of speculation. And then finally, the thing that really is like the nail in the coffin for me is, why would it do that? Well, in many ways, to show that, well, you know, she had a tragic life, and here's her downfall and so on. And you know what? Even though, like, you would think the FBI would be the villains in this piece, well, no, there's at least one good FBI agent with a conscience. And, you know, almost like trying to be fair and balanced that way. Well, listen, not everyone in the FBI is vile, right? Here's this really good guy. And I thought, well, okay, I can accept that, but do I have to spend, like, another 10 minutes, you know, dwelling on that in the film? What do you think?
Well, I think they could have spent more time on her personal story. You know, she had a baby that didn't survive because she had overdosed on sleeping pills when she was pregnant. And so every year on the anniversary of this child's death, she would try to attempt suicide, including a failed attempt to throw herself in front of a train.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, that's why they think, her, when she finally did die, it was probably another attempt at suicide. And they didn't find her until 11 days later, which
I
I'm like,
know.
how does that even happen?
It's so heartbreaking. Well, because at that point, she was no longer, really a player, if you will. She died in 1979, so she really hadn't been a presence in Hollywood for a while. And, even though we say 40 is like really young, not in Hollywood years. The fact that her screen career had dried up already, right? So if you're
Right.
a Hollywood actress in your mid to late 30s and you're not getting the roles, and then what you do appear in doesn't click, and nothing quite coheres, and if your personal life is a mess, you know what? They drop you pretty fast, don't they? So in other words, by the time she was in her late 30s, she was a has-been, and she was just becoming so reclusive that it's incredibly sad to talk about this, but when she died, and we assume it was a suicide, but again, we don't know definitively, but in any event, whether it was, a suicide or accidental, the fact that she wouldn't even be found for all those days is really just heartbreak on top of heartbreak there.
Yeah, no one should go out like that. I will say the two pluses for this movie. I thought Kristen Stewart did a decent job, and I thought it was casting genius to cast Yvonne Attal as Rumon Gary, because he is in real life married to Charlotte Gainsbourg,
Yeah.
and they did a great movie together called My Wife is an Actress, which is
Oh,
all
yeah.
about, the
Yeah.
backstory of what goes on, et cetera, with his real life wife, Charlotte Gainsbourg, playing herself. Very tongue in cheek, very funny. So having him be, the one of the love interests in this movie, I thought was a clever nod to, here's a guy who really knows what it's like behind the scenes.
Well, you know what? I agree with you absolutely. It was inspired casting. By the same token, though, I didn't really get as full a sense as I wanted of the marital connection. You know what I mean? Within the film. I mean, in real life, it's really intriguing, and there's a lot to say against Rumon Gary in terms of how he treated her and so on. But in the film, I just, honestly wanted like more screen time, more running time devoted to, what that marriage would have been like. You know what I mean? It's just the film kind of jumps around a little too quickly with some of that.
I think it focuses a lot on her paranoia, which kind of goes into our second film we're going to talk about, which is The Invisible Man. Unless you are,
Yes.
okay, I'm going to go with Invisible Man. What I found was interesting is I saw these two movies on the same day, and I thought, how interesting that in both movies you have female leads saying, why doesn't anybody believe me? There is somebody following me, and there's somebody in the house. And people just keep telling them, you're losing your mind or you're
Well, you know,
imagining.
I. No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's all. That's my intro
Oh,
to
well, it reminds me of
segue.
one of my favorite. It just reminds me of one of my favorite quotes about paranoia. It was Thomas Pynchon who wrote that. Even paranoids have enemies, and it's that feeling. Because really, with Jean Seberg, I mean, she had reason to be paranoid, right? Like,
Yes.
as you and I talk now, I wonder who else is on our line, right? Who's tapping our call? Who's checking in on us? But I mean, she, again, joking aside on that, I mean, she really was persecuted, and again, that kind of persecution is certainly validated in Invisible Man as we talk about it. Tell you what I want to do with Invisible Man here, just by way of reminding the audience of the lineage here. It goes back to an H.G. Wells novel from 1897. And the reason in particular I mention that isn't just to show that the property's been with us a while, but there's a subtitle to the Wells novel that has generally been forgotten. But the full title of his novel is The Invisible Man, colon, A Grotesque Romance. And that's what I find fascinating about how the romance gets treated in the film we're discussing. It certainly is grotesque in a lot of ways. But then, just to take us forward in terms of film history, Universal, which was very smart about snapping up monsters in the early 30s, right? So many of the remakes we get today, from Universal, they're remaking films they made in the early 1930s. So, not to get sidetracked with that, but the most famous film version was the Universal release from 1933, directed by James Whale, who of course had also earlier done Frankenstein, and there starring Claude Rains, sometimes jokingly referred to as the invisible actor. And the reason I want to harp on that for a moment is that in the 1933 version, Claude Rains plays the kind of mad scientist you expect in a Hollywood movie from the early 30s, right? Think about Frankenstein, Invisible Man, others. And in that film, the Claude Rains character actually has the line, quote, "An invisible man can rule the world!" Exclamation point. Close quote. And so the reason that that's worth dwelling on is when you think about it, how often there you have in science fiction and fantasy horror, these scientists, these ego-driven scientists who really feel like, as in Frankenstein, now in the name of God and know what it is to be God, that they have these godlike egos. And so the reason in particular we should mention that a bit is in that most famous film version of Invisible Man, it's very much the male ego. It's very much the male mad scientist and the consequences of what happens there. What makes the current remake Invisible Man that you and I are talking about so relevant and so much in terms of zeitgeist something from our period is the fact that it kind of flips the equation. The focus here isn't so much on a man who's a mad scientist, though that's certainly in the film, but the focus is more on the man's ex-girlfriend, the character Cecilia, played by Elizabeth Moss. And I thought, well, this is very much a movie for 2020. What do you think?
Well, I absolutely love the casting of Elizabeth Moss in this, but, can they please make a movie or something with her where she ends up with a nice guy? Because she's
not
so
going to happen.
For the Handmaid's
not,
Tale. That you see her in this and you just think, you poor woman, somebody needs to introduce you to better people. I did like her in this. I think I wasn't that thrilled with the actor playing the Invisible Man, partly because I heard that they were considering Armie Hammer or Alexander Skarsgård for that.
Ooh, they would have been great.
Both of those guys would have been really awesome in this movie.
Oliver Jackson Cohen, who plays Adrian, the character, he's okay. I mean, he's not bad, but the problem is partly in the scripting that his character doesn't go very deep. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Because we spend so much time with Elizabeth Moss's character and her paranoia. And in terms of her playing that kind of a character, I think what you're getting at is that, she's appearing in a lot of films and she's kind of being typecast or quasi-typecast. That there's certain roles. And, you would almost want to see her, break out with something different. But within this role, she's fine in the role. She's very convincing in it, actually. But the problem in terms of the film not quite being in balance is, although I think it's an interesting and certainly timely way of updating it, is to have the focus be more on her than on him. In terms of the him here, Adrian becomes like a stock villain, doesn't he? You don't really have any depth psychology to it. What do you think there? Because I just thought he was kind of like, not boring, but just like so predictably vile.
He has kind of the Ray Liotta way of approaching the
Ooh.
Yes. He's always sinister, but he's sinister because he's sinister. You can't imagine why she liked him in the first place.
Well, thank you for saying that, because you always wonder how people met or what holds them together. But this was a case of, like, it was so extreme. I thought, well, why would she have been with him? I couldn't see what the attraction would have been, because there's no understatement, there's no kindness, there's nothing leavening there in his character. It's just so flat and so all out, ego-driven and vile that even when you do spend time with him, it's usually in those action-oriented scenes where he's threatening violence or he's smashing something or this or that. And I thought, well, number one, how did you two ever get together? Why are you with him? But then number two, get out. Like sometimes you're watching a movie and you just want to tell the character, get out of the room or get out of the relationship.
Yes, do something about it now. Yes, it does do a good job, I think, in the movie of showing you all the ways, you could torment somebody if you were invisible. That's, I think,
I learned a lot from it, I know.
But one real criticism I have is that the trailer, which they, they really put that out there big time. There's this awesome scene where she's in the shower and then you see this, handprint on the shower. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. That never shows up in the movie. If you're waiting
for
the movie, where's that scene? When is that scene? And they don't have it in the movie.
No, in fact, thank you for saying that, because over the years, we should do a program on that sometimes. You would see trailers, and I don't want to get sidelined with talking about trailers and all their many sins, but one of them is sometimes you'll get a scene like that in the trailer that doesn't actually appear in the film itself. And oftentimes it's a scene where you think it should, right? You think, that's the highlight.
Looking scene.
It is. And I don't know in this particular case what happened, why that scene didn't make the cut. But you would think, just because this film is very action-oriented, it really is violence-driven, right? It's not just psychological horror and paranoia. There's a lot of actual violence here, or near violence. And that scene you mentioned that was excised from the trailer, that would have certainly fit within the flow of the film.
It also is a nice little homage to Psycho. Woman in the shower, doesn't know that, there's the murderer standing right outside the shower curtain. Or the
I remember when I first saw the trailer, I immediately thought of Psycho. And maybe, now this is very much a maybe statement. I mean, I would think they'd want to evoke that and play on it a bit, and they certainly do in the trailer. But maybe within the film, they thought that would have been a little too much of like an inside joke that goes outside, if you know what I mean, like kind of distracting that way, like you almost expect to hear the shrieking violins on the soundtrack or something. You know what I mean? I mean, this is entirely conjectural on my part, but maybe they just thought it was like pushing a little too far and an obvious nod to Psycho. I don't know, but all things considered, I would have left it in.
I definitely would have left it in because you're watching the whole movie waiting for it to happen. And then you think, did I miss something?
Well, yeah, that's actually like, I mean, I always stay in the seat. I don't ever leave the theater, but there's always that, speaking of paranoia, like, what, this is not the 5 minutes to go out for popcorn, right? You know what I mean? It's just like, stay in your seat, you know, that kind of like stay in your seat moment. But I know what you're saying, like, and then it becomes distracting. And this is something that they should have given some thought to. If you have a striking moment in the trailer, people wait for it in the film. And if it doesn't appear by that, the midpoint, it becomes a fixation, doesn't it? You're supposed to
Yes.
think about it. You keep thinking, well, she's overdue for a shower. You know what I mean? Hit the showers, you know?
Yeah, what are we getting in that shower? Yes, let's
I
get
know.
it.
So
Although,
like even like joking aside on that you don't want to get the audience distracted that way. And that happened for you then. And that's a mark against the, not the film so much as I would say the marketing of it, right? How they're pitching it.
my biggest complaint with most trailers is that they show you the whole movie. So
Well, you know what?
why go see it? But a lot of
What?
students will say to me, "Oh, well, the movie was all right, but they put the best stuff in the trailer," which is also
Well, you
just
know where I noticed that
complaint.
was they do put the best stuff in the trailer. There have been some comedies where every good joke is in the trailer, and so when I go to see the film, I think, okay, it has five good jokes, and I've heard them already. And as you're watching a film, it's like a checklist, isn't it? Okay, that one, that one, that one, and that's it. Those are the highlights. But in a violent film, in a slasher film like this one, and this is a slasher film basically, I'm reminded of the trailers going back, gosh, 20 or more years. You'd see a trailer for a Friday the 13th type movie, where you know that the bad guy, whether it's Freddy or Jason, whoever, the guy's going to kill, 10 or 12 nubile teenagers, right? And so watching the film, it's predictable already that you shouldn't go camping in the woods at night, right? And you shouldn't be making out with your boyfriend because the monster will get you. But when you see all the highlights or the lowlights, depending on your perspective, when you see all those in the trailer itself, and I swear to goodness that there would be Friday the 13th type movies where I'd see the trailer, and if there were like 12 grisly killings within the film, all of them were in the trailer, like bang, 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 and slam, bang, editing and sound. And I thought, well, I've seen the movie, right? I mean, if you're a bloodthirsty viewer and that's what you're going for, you get all of that in the trailer. And then when you watch the film, it becomes even more predictable. It's like the moment you see somebody walking towards the woods, it's like, oh, I know what's going to happen to her.
Well, then there's the music that starts to build up, and then there's a moment of pause, and the next thing is the monster jumping down your neck. This is when I hide under my coat.
Well, see, those are the jump scare moments that become too predictable and kind of risible. They actually sort of insult the audience's intelligence. You know that if the woman's alone in the house at night and she's getting scared and paranoid and has reason to, there'll be that initial false scare that, oh, it was just the cat walking across the kitchen floor, or it was just a branch rustling against the window, or the door slamming on its owners. But then like a moment after that, things calm down, the soundtrack is quiet, and then the bad guy or the monster, leaps out. But that's so tightly calibrated and timed and so predictable that honestly, at this point, it's not a genuine scare. It's more a matter of you become even more keenly aware of the mechanics of scaring an audience.
So we're almost out of time. Any last things you want to say about the director, Lee Whannell?
Not particularly, but what I will say on the director's behalf is, in terms of the production design, the setting, and so on, it actually plays out quite well there because our monster of a man, Adrian, lives in this house, which is modernist, but in a way that's really cold and kind of frightening. It's just like really sterile that way, and it's right on the edge of the Pacific, but in the sense of like being on a cliffside. Like you could tumble down a cliff, or you could fall in the ocean, or whatever. But there actually are, in terms of the actual staging of the film, there's some very effective scenes just in terms of you're alone in the house and you think the guy's gonna come after you, and just simply the staging of it in terms of the house itself being so swank. I mean, it's like a Shelter magazine house. It's really so modernistic, so cutting edge, but it has minimal furnishings and just like as if the stylist came in and had everything measured to the inch and everything laid out in terms of color or lack of color. And it actually was kind of brutal in that respect. It's like this is not like exactly the warm hearth, if you know what I mean. It's somebody who has, this guy Adrian has a lot of money and strictly speaking good taste, as in modernist taste, but there's something lacking, like a soul, a heart. art and, you know, other things that are nice to have in a human being. And the house reflects that very well.
The house looks like what would happen if Bill Gates went bad.
Well, I'll convey your greetings. You're right, though, actually. I mean, if someone with that much money, and also in terms of somebody with that much money, I mean, there's a lot of cleverness involved here, but some of it's borderline implausible, isn't it? I mean, in terms
of,
like, you
know. Oh,
it's more
than borderline, but yeah, you have to suspend disbelief even for the idea of invisibility. But
well, the stuff that he's able to do and the kind of spying and the payback and all, it's like so elaborate, not just expensive, but so elaborate that, yeah, either borderline or just simply implausible at times. Like, geez, you know, like you know, get a separation, get a divorce, move to another house. You know, all these things in which you could get out of a bad relationship, right?
Nope, invisibility, that's the way to go.
Yeah, and it's actually fun. That movie has like a fun premise, doesn't it? I mean, because we do it like, what if you were invisible, the things you could do, right? It is kind of fun just to play with that.
It is fun to play with that, actually. And I think that is one of the reasons why the movie franchise is evergreen, because, you know, invisibility is one of those superpowers everybody would like to have, but not necessarily to do bad things. But then there is that aspect.
Well, in a movie like this one, they're not going to get invisible to do good things, are they? Like, I want to do somebody a favor and they won't know. I'll be anonymous. You know, I mean, good Samaritans, you know, do not become invisible, but mad scientists do.
You know, that is a really deep statement, and I think we will leave on that one. So if you are trapped at home, check out The Invisible Man and or Seberg for something a little different in both respects. And just remember, because you're paranoid doesn't mean that people aren't out to get you.
All right. Also,
check us out online for some of our other programs at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.